Today's episode is brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook. My name is Justin Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. My goal for this podcast is to have world-class experts share their story along with their hard-earned insights. Often these people are so busy perfecting their craft, they don't have a chance to pass along their lessons learned. Hopefully you can take away some actionable advice and motivation and see what it takes to become the best in the world. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that I've found over the month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. My guest today is Chris Voss, who served as the lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI. During his career, he worked on over 150 international hostage cases. During his 24-year tenure, he was trained in the art of negotiation not only by the FBI, but by Scotland Yard and Harvard Law School. He is also a recipient of the Attorney General's Award for Excellence and the FBI Agents Association Award for Distinguished and Exemplary Service. Here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
If I'm a terrorist and I say, you know what, we want all U.S. forces out of Iraq in the next 48 hours. As a negotiator, I can say, seems like you've given us a lot of thought. Person on the other side has given it a lot of thought. And since they put that much effort into it, they're actually dying to tell me. And what I just said, seems like you've given this a lot of thought, is actually a very specifically worded, every word in that sentence has been selected to unlock you and get you gushing at me about everything you've been thinking about.
Chris is a master negotiator who has since written one of the top books in the field titled Never Split the Difference. He also works as an adjunct professor at USC's Marshall School of Business and Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. In our conversation, we talk about what it's like to be on the phone with a terrorist, the traits required of a hostage negotiator, how everyone can become better at negotiating, and more. Now, without further ado, Chris Voss. Chris, sir, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, man. This could be an interesting conversation. Let's do it.
So can you talk to the big picture of your career and hit the highlights along the way?
I was a small-town Midwestern guy. I was a cop in Kansas City. Became an FBI agent, joined ultimately about 2 years in, signed to the Joint Terrorist Task Force in New York City. Worked terrorism and hostage negotiation while I was there. The birth of Al-Qaeda was really as a result of the first World Trade Center bombing. Principally because the person that was vying against Osama bin Laden for leadership of that world at the time was a guy named Sheikh Omar Ali Abdel Rahman, who was in the U.S. We locked him up. He was doing life plus 60, but he came to the end of his life in federal custody. So war terrorism, principally domestic, then international in New York City. Became a hostage negotiator, ran a team in New York. Got promoted to the full-time unit, Quantico, the infamous magical place, Quantico. Both the FBI and the U.S. Marines, Marine Corps officers training occurs there. Got put in charge of international kidnapping response, worked kidnappings around the globe, and then moved on. Left, went to Harvard, like Rodney Dangerfield from an old movie called Back to School. I definitely felt like the old guy in a young person environment. Wrote a book on applying hostage negotiation to business. As we speak, it's number 17 on Amazon overall, most read, most sold in all categories. It's been leading the business negotiation category since it came out.
So what's that moment like when you first get on the phone and you're starting to talk to a terrorist or criminal? Can you paint a picture of what that situation is like?
Yeah, you know, it depends upon your prep. There's an old saying, you don't rise to the occasion, you fall to your highest level of preparation. If you're prepared, you fall into it. It's like any other training. It's like flying a fighter if you spend enough time in a simulation, if you spend enough time prepping. if your simulation was good, if you worked at it, if you believe in a process. First time I got on the phone in a real deal, if you will, it was a bank robbery with hostages. While those occur in the movies all the time, in real life, they're extremely rare events. Banks get robbed all the time. Hostages get taken all the time. Rarely are the bad guys trapped inside and there's an actual hostage negotiation. They take the hostages to get into the vault. They know the police are on the way to get out of there. I was prepped. I believed in a process. I had spent a lot of time on a suicide hotline. I felt like I could handle anything. Suicide hotlines are the best training for any kind of negotiation. And I'd been through the classic Quantico by that time. And I was maintaining my training in any skills-based performance. You know, you got to maintain your training. It's not riding a bike. You know, you don't learn to fly a fighter jet and then not get in one for 3 years and assume that you can fly it again. You know, you got to keep your skill level up. And my skill level was up, and I was ready to rock. I couldn't wait to get on the phone. I relied on my training, and I got a bad guy out.
Yeah, what was that first time like showing up? Do they have comms with the guys that are in the bank, and they're just waiting on a negotiator to show up, and then all eyes are on you?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, from the time the bank robbery alarm goes off, if you trap them inside, to the time you're set up to talk is going to be at least 2 hours. They got to get the place surrounded. They got to find a command post to put you in wherever you are. You're obviously not at the bank when the bank robbers rolled in. This bank robbery happened to be in Brooklyn. I was in Lower Manhattan, you know, found out about the alarm almost like right after it happened. And heading toward the bank robbery to getting set up is a good solid 2 hours. You got a fair amount of intel that you've gathered by the time you're getting ready to pick up the phone. The negotiators get organized. You work as a team. You got a team leader, signs roles. You gather the available intel. The crazy thing about it was the intel was bad intel that had been purposely planted by the bad guys. So we started off, you know, whenever you find intel, you got to find what's the intel and where did it come from. The intel we found out after the fact came from the bad guys, and they were the guy behind the scenes in the bank was busy trying to figure a way out. And the first thing he did to try to figure a way out was he was smart enough to know that if the threat level was low, if it didn't look like they were going to kill people right away, they probably wouldn't get shot. So he called the local precinct and said that he wanted to surrender. This was a lie. But we roll up on a scene, and the intel is already these bad guys are looking to come out. Smart move on his part. I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that the year before, a hijacked plane landed JFK in New York City. And while the plane was on the way, the bad guy wanted to surrender. It was a guy in Germany who wanted to ride to the U.S. So, you know, people don't always do the smartest things. He figured he'd get a free ride if he hijacked the plane. You know, you get a free ride and you get free room and board once you show up. You know, so, but there was a precedent for it in New York City at the time. I don't know if this guy knew about it, but he was smart enough to know that it lessened the likelihood that we would come crashing through the doors if they thought he was coming out. So we had bad intel from the beginning.
And what's that first conversation like with him?
Well, my first conversation was I was handed the phone. I was the second negotiator on the phone. First negotiator had been on the phone for quite a while, so I had a good feel for the dynamic. And so I got some real explicit instructions from the commander of the NYPD team at the time. This is Lieutenant Hugh McGowan. Hugh was a seasoned dude, very low key. And he said, look, here's what I want you to do. And he laid it out for me. And so it was easy for me. I had good, solid instruction. And you come up with a game plan. And, you know, the game plan never survives the first encounter with the battlefield. So you understand flexibility. It's like, you know, when the ball snaps on a football field or when a jump ball, as soon as the ball's tipped. I mean, you got a game plan, but you got to react to the game as it's going on. So I expected, you know, all sorts of twists and turns. And if you expect them, then you're not caught off guard with them and you're ready.
And is the first thing that you're trying to do is build rapport with them so that they trust you so that whatever deal you make, they'll believe it's coming?
As a general rule, you're looking to build rapport, you know, and then you have to slice and dice the concepts. Like I'm basically, hostage negotiators start out with something that we call the late night FM DJ voice. Now that voice is very calming. We didn't have neuroscience at the time, but we have it now. I now know that when I use that voice, the sound triggers something in your brain called a mirror neuron. It's an involuntary response. It's like when the doctor taps your knee with the tiny little hammer and your leg kicks. It's an involuntary response. So I know that if you hear my voice, when I use that, it hits your mirror neurons and actually releases a chemical change in your brain. It's like giving you a small shot of anesthesia, and it chills you out. It calms you down. It's an involuntary response. So my first goal to calm things down is to hit this guy's mirror neurons, which in fact calms him down. That's actually the first goal. So you gain the upper hand. Simultaneously, you start to establish trust and rapport, because when you calm someone down, they tend to start trusting you. It tends to start the rapport process. So all this stuff comes as a follow-on.
And is the rapport basically doing what you say you're going to do? If you're going to bring in food, that you bring in food at the time you say you are?
Yeah. That sounds simplistic, but it's real easy to make empty promises and not back them up. So the first move is to not make any promises and to be clear on it, because you go a long way if you tell somebody right off the bat, instead of like, look, I'm here, I'm the guy that's going to help you. You know, you make all kinds of false promises. If you start out and you go like, hey, you know, it's kind of tough out here. It's going to be hard for me to do anything for you. I just want to want you to know up front, you know, it's a circus out here. So if you ask me for something, it's going to take a while.
So I read that you've, on the conservative side, done over 150 negotiations. What are some of the typical ebbs and flows of a negotiation?
First off is, kind of feeling the other side out. It's really trying to understand, what's our communication going to look like? Is this person going to lie to me, by and large? Are they going to deceive me? Are they going to try and trap me? So, you're kind of feeling the other side out and understanding what the big mistakes are. Like, I would never say anybody, I want to help you. Because they're like, all right, you want to help me? Give me $1 million. I can't do that. Well, I guess you don't want to help. So you got to be careful of the buzzwords. It's really more, what do you avoid to feel the other side out? Because the other side has been con so many times. Even in regular everyday life, people often overpromise and underdeliver. So how do you start out so that you don't overpromise? So you don't con the other side. How do you really establish trust? Another word for trust, which we teach people on a regular basis, get rid of the word trust and put in predictability. Like if I tell somebody I'll be there in 5 minutes, I'll probably be there in 3. What am I giving you to predict? I'm either going to hit the time mark or I'm going to beat it. Now, most people say I'll be there in 5 minutes, and it's anywhere from 15 to 30. I hate that. I'm 5 minutes away. I'm 5 minutes away. No, you're not. But you're saying that because you don't want to let me down. But in fact, now you're making this unpredictable. One of my favorites, I'm a big fan of Bill McCraven, Admiral Bill McCraven. He just put out a book about his career. He previously put out the book, Make Your Bed, former Navy SEAL, caught responsible for capture of both Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. McCraven, in his early days as a SEAL, they're doing an exercise in the Caribbean, and they got underwater subs. And these guys come out, but they're exposed to the water. And, you can get hypothermia in the Caribbean. So the chopper that's supposed to extract them is not there. And they start calling, where's the chopper? Where's the chopper? And, the chopper's 15 minutes up. 3 hours later, the chopper shows up. Now, when the chopper told them they were 15 minutes out, there's no way that they were unaware that it was going to take them 3 hours to get there. Very well-intentioned. We don't want to disappoint the guys, but you're completely unpredictable then. If you say 15 minutes and it's anywhere from 15 minutes to 3 hours, how am I supposed to predict that? So understanding what predictability really means and how to establish predictability in a relationship is really the key to trust. Do I know what you're going to do? Or do I know that whatever you say, the only thing predictable about you is that you're unreliable? Those are tiny little things that make a massive difference in all interactions.
Right. Managing expectations, not overpromising, so the other side can trust that you're going to do what you say you're going to do.
Yeah. Everybody says that all the time. But in practical application, what does it really mean? And most people fail at it utterly, just utterly.
Right. And it seems to be, from my perspective, as the pressure goes up, people get a little bit more afraid to actually speak the truth.
Yeah, which makes it worse. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes it worse. I'm dealing with a colleague recently. We're trying to find an attorney. We're trying to get some, trying to find some advice. He brings somebody to me. This is a perfect person. This is a person that's going to help it. They're going to solve it all. And I'm like, fine, bring him on board. And so the problem is still eating at me, and I haven't got it solved. So finally I get back to this guy, and I'm like, look, what's the story? You promised me 2 weeks ago you're bringing this person on board. The problem has not gone away, and I need to know right now whether I need to go a new direction. And he was like, hey, yeah, well, the person told me yesterday they didn't want to be involved, and I didn't know how to break the bad news for you. And I'm thinking, like, all right, so you left me hanging for a day. The pressure's on. You got bad news. You're scared to tell me. But I just blew a day of planning that I would like to have back. So, the ability to deliver bad news as soon as you've got it is critical. And most people don't do it. In the helicopter story, we're not going to be there for 3 hours. Well, at least now I know. But instead, they say, I'm going to be there for 15 minutes, and you leave people hanging. It's extremely critical when the pressure's on and people are waiting. And that's where people most often fail.
What are some other characteristics that are required of a hostage negotiator?
Yeah, if you're going to be any good at it, you got to want to get better. Now, that sounds like a cliche, but you only have the ability to get better one of two ways. If you're open to learning, and not everybody is, or if you're a hard worker, and not everybody is. Now, I like to think I'm both. If I hear a new idea, I go, wow, that's really interesting. Let me see how it works, and I'll try it. Most people, when you tell them a new idea, they go like, yeah, I've been doing that for a long time. And then they tell you how they've been doing it, and they haven't. Well, what that person is they're not really open to learning. They're trying to fit everything new they hear into their old patterns. So this is a person that's not particularly open to learning. And, then of course, I've met people who were not necessarily open to learning, but they worked so hard, it didn't make any difference. I mean, 14-hour day is nothing to them. So you gotta be open to learning, or be willing to stay at it till you figure it out. Is what it really boils down to.
Is there any trait though that new negotiators have issues learning?
Well, every new negotiator is going to have some kind of new issue, and they actually have a tendency to fall into one of three categories, because we're really kind of one of three breeds of cat from our caveman days, our prehistoric wiring. The cavemen that survived when they saw a threat were those that ran from it, took it head on, or found a way to collaborate with it. So fight, flight, make friends. Those are the caveman responses to danger. And the world breaks pretty evenly into thirds. So I'm a fight type of guy. If I saw a saber-toothed tiger, and I'm going to pick up a rock and go after it. I take stuff head on. So my challenge is just doing the same thing, but being a little nicer about it, a little softer about it, maybe hesitating for half a second, maybe shutting up when I feel like I want to talk. Those are my challenges. If you're a collaborative person, if your gut instinct is to make friends with something, well, your challenge is going to be telling the truth when it's difficult to tell the truth, because you're going to be scared to tell the truth because you're afraid it's going to damage the relationship. So telling the truth, really, really hard for you because you're afraid it's going to hurt the relationship. Your definition of a white lie is as big as a Grand Canyon because you're afraid of harming a relationship. If you're a flight guy, these are highly analytical people. They see conflict as highly unproductive. Let me step back and figure a way around the problem instead of through the problem. You're avoiding the problem by doing that. And some problems are going to chase you down. So you have to learning when to engage instead of deferring engagement. That's really going to be your challenge. So it's going to be one of those three kind of challenges depending upon how your caveman wiring is.
I listened to you speak, and you said during your time at the FBI, there were only five people on the planet that were good at dealing with barricaded suspects as well as international kidnappers. What kind of traits are required for both of those, and why is that so rare?
All right, so barricaded suspects, let's look at it like this. You're on a sell side. One of my colleagues used to say, you know, I sell jail sentences and I have buyers. I mean, you kind of pitch it from your side. And not that many, there are a lot of hostage negotiators. If you have one barricade that you've worked, you're already in an elite level because there's so many that never even get a shot at one barricade. And that's very definitely, that's kind of sell side, if you will. So to begin with, if you got any experience there, you're the next level up. And that happens because, for example, there are 400 hostage negotiators in the FBI in order to cover the entire country. But if there are 400 of us spread across the country, only, you know, 4, 5, 6 of us each year get a shot to have something happen in the area that we cover. So then kidnapping, that's a whole different breed of cat. That's kind of buy side. You know, somebody's got something and you're trying to get something out of them. They got a commodity they're trying to trade for whatever they're looking for, whether it's a political demand, whether it's money. So that's a completely different approach. And kidnapping then is a next level up, and you have to have a lot of experience on the sell side, you know, the barricade, before anybody gives you a shot at kidnapping. And then you not only have to have a lot of experience and have demonstrated a tremendous desire to learn, then you got to get selected, and then something's got to come up when you've been selected. And generally speaking, when I was running our international kidnap response, I had a team of 90 people. And not all of them, you know, got called into the big game, but they put me in coordination. So I was either handling directly every single kidnapping the U.S. was handling, or I was overseeing it. And so by virtue of my position, now how many people like that end up at that intersection in the world? Well, by and large, there's a few from Scotland Yard and there's a few from Canada. And those guys in Scotland Yard and Canada may not have had the experience that I'd had domestically on, you know, on a cell side, because I'd been very active and I'd been in the middle of some rare events. So I was really lucky that I found myself in the intersection of two worlds, which is how I ended up with, at the time, you know, realistically, there were about 5 of us on the entire planet that had been lucky enough to be in that position.
Have you always been good at this? Were you negotiating with your parents for a later bedtime when you were a kid?
No. But I think, you know, maybe the trait that I look back on the most, I always like the idea of being proactive. I like the idea of figuring out how to get in front of a problem and diffuse it. You know, if the train's coming at me, how do I get the train stopped before it runs me down? You know, how do I got to get off the tracks? I mean, I think I've always been a very proactive human being. And so that, to figure stuff out before other people did or get out in front of problems, I think is, you know, kind of why that I took to this and have enjoyed it so much.
Are there any negotiations that were especially challenging or that you're especially proud of?
Yeah, well, you know, all of the above. I mean, one of the cases that's in my book, Never Split the Difference, the first kidnapping I worked in the Philippines, we diffused what the bad guys were doing sufficiently. They become sufficiently disheartened. They completely dropped the ransom demand entirely. And then while they were trying to figure out how to get what they wanted, they became so disorganized on their side that our hostage walked away. I mean, a hostage negotiator, he's done his job if he creates a condition where the hostage simply escapes, walks away on his own because, you know, you created enough of a distraction, the bad guys didn't figure it out. Or, you know, maybe you design a rescue. And again, there's no exchange of value or perceived value. You're trying to create a situation where great things happen. So this case in the Philippines, not only does our hostage walk away, which leaves the hostage takers with nothing, but the terrorist, literally 2 weeks after the case is over, calls the negotiator I coached to let him know how much he respected him. And considering the bad guy placing a call was a sociopathic killer who got nothing, having him call his counterpart out of respect is just a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, that seems very counterintuitive that somebody who kind of got the short end of a deal would call and compliment his nemesis.
It does. You know, and for all intents and purposes, though, when we teach this negotiation now, what we really stress is you combine deference and respect in a collaborative environment, and the other side is always going to want to deal with you again. Don't look at any negotiation as a one-off. You're kidding yourself if you think it's a one-off. So always leave the other side feeling like they would deal with you again, because lo and behold, there's a really good chance you're going to anyway.
What about on the other side of the coin? Are there any negotiations that didn't quite go the way you wanted to? And then if so, how do you mentally reset and recover from that for the next negotiation?
Yeah, well, you're rarely surprised if you're paying attention. Now, just because you're not surprised doesn't mean it's still not going to go bad. You may see from the very beginning, this is going to go bad. Now, back in the Philippines again on another case, not terribly long after the first one, and the bad guys are particularly on their guard, because they're aware that they didn't get anything out of the last one. So they're absolutely determined to get something out of this one. And what this ends up happening in this one, there's a botched rescue attempt by the Philippine military. And while the remaining hostages weren't harmed by the kidnappers, two out of three of the remaining hostages were killed in a botched rescue attempt. And that sure is not what we had in mind. We actually thought we were going to get them out sooner than that, and we never got them out. But the reality is, there's no guarantee of success in any business. You want to do something that gives you the best chance of success, which means some are going to go bad. But it also means, what do you do when you hit that iceberg? Do you sink like the Titanic, or do you decide to pull yourself together and get better? And I found that to be that emotional moment happened in every negotiator's career, where if they did enough cases, just based on the numbers, something was going to go bad. Now, are they going to sink and give up and say, I want to do something else? Or are they going to double down and say, you know what? This means I have to get better. And my particular choice was, I'm not going to quit, so I'm going to get better.
What are the debriefs like? As a fighter pilot, that's pretty much where we do most of our learning. We'll, for an hour and a half flight, have a 3 to 5 hour debrief going through every single decision that we made. Was it the right? Was it the wrong one? Is it something similar as a negotiator?
It should be, but it's not. I mean, it's one of the things the military is ahead of the game on. It really is on the focus on the debriefs. So, some of us would try really hard to try to, get feedback from our colleagues to get better, but it wasn't a structured process. I mean, and, being concerned about hurting people's feelings is just such an ongoing problem in these operations that, we call it a hot wash after an exercise or after a real scenario. We'd want to get people's thoughts. But, we just had, I don't know anybody in law enforcement that's really structured it enough so that they could have a candid, collaborative, constructive hot wash. So I would go back to my colleagues and I would struggle with this stuff, but I'd have to go back to the guys that were as focused as me on learning and getting better, to get the candid feedback.
So you hit on the voice a little bit. Can you expand on that and talk about how that fits into body language?
The vast majority of the message is not the words. Somewhere between 80 and 93% of any given message is other than the words. How the words are delivered, tone of voice, and if you're lucky enough to factor body language in. So the real issue on any of that stuff is it in line? I mean, never mind what the percentages are. Check to see if whether or not it's in line. But then, what does in line mean? It's in line for that person. And the sort of the best way to look at it is the way a polygraph works. If you take a polygraph and you got a good polygrapher, what they want to do is they want to lay down your baseline, how you tell the truth, and the way they do that is they ask you some questions. What day is it? What city are you in? What's your name? You get a picture of what somebody looks like when they tell the truth. Now they put all those wires and gauges on you because they want to see when you come out of the truth. When you flinch, when your heart rate goes up, when your breathing slows down, when you hold your breath, when you look up, when you look left, whatever any one of those 90 different things that they in poker they refer to as tells, what those different tells might be. They don't care what your tell is. All they know is that you look different than when you're telling the truth. So when people start looking at body language, there is no one hack because everybody's baseline for truth telling is their own baseline. So that's why instead of trying to read whether or not somebody looks up or looks down when they're lying, you engage in a conversation to find out what they look like when they're telling the truth. And then all you know is that they're no longer telling the truth and you got to figure that out.
So the primary thing you're doing when you're talking with somebody, negotiating with somebody, is seeing if they're being authentic.
Yeah, and you experiment with them a little bit. And it's really, your gut instinct is ridiculously good. if you feed that computer. I mean, your intuition is fed from your subconscious, and your subconscious is a supercomputer that there ain't a computer on a planet yet that can touch it. And that's what a lot of people, they start reacting to their gut. They say, you know, I'm getting a bad feeling out of this guy. Somebody's saying that, you know, it just leaves me uneasy. So you interact with people long enough to build your gut instinct for what they look like when they're telling the truth. And in most cases, people, you don't know that that's happening. I mean, in a business world, that's why most people want to play golf with somebody. The thing is to establish rapport, but it actually takes them about eight hours of interaction on a golf course, watching a guy, you know, when is he going to kick it out of the rough with his feet or pick it up and throw it out of the rough? Or when is he going to try to hit it from there? Or, you know, when he's on a green, is it gimme, is it for him, is it gimme 6 inches from the hole, or is it gimme 4 feet from the hole? You develop a feel for what this person is like. Or you go to dinner with somebody. You know, you have a 3-hour meal, people relax when they're at dinner, they have a couple drinks. I mean, you want to see what the person is really like. This is, everybody's laying down their baseline of what does somebody look like when they're being authentic. Hostage negotiator's job is just figure that out much quicker. And if that's what we're looking for in a conversation, we know what we're looking for, which is basically alignment, it's a lot easier.
So how much overlap is there? It seems like a lot between negotiating with terrorists and negotiating a business deal.
You know, the crazy thing is that the human nature rules, the rules for human nature apply regardless of the circumstances of the situation. We're driven by the same emotions. We make our decisions that weighing in the same factors. Well, what are those factors? Those factors are what do we perceive we're losing? Danny Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for something called prospect theory, the Nobel Prize for behavioral economics. Prospect theory tells us that a loss thinks twice as much as an equivalent gain. It doesn't say that it only applies to Westerners or Christians or Muslims or Africans or Western Europeans or Latinos. It applies to everybody's human being. And so when you begin to understand what the drivers of human behavior are, regardless of the circumstances, then you realize that hostage negotiation skills apply all the time.
So you are trying to identify the X number of things that the person is afraid of happening and then finding solutions to those.
Yeah. And understanding what hidden fears look like. Or like anger is always a result of fear of loss. Genuine anger, it's a threat response. And a lot of people misinterpret anger. Are you trying to take advantage of me? No, you feel threatened right now. I got to figure out, and you're threatened over losing something. So it's understanding all the different ways that fear of loss hides itself and how it will manifest itself in disguise. And then now that's the thread that you follow. If you're angry about something, you're afraid of losing something. And people get really self-righteous when they're angry. Which means they're going to talk. The more self-righteous you feel, the more likely you are to talk. So I love it when somebody's angry because if I know what's, I know the fear of loss is hidden in there, like, cool, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, it sounds like you've given this a lot of thought. I'm going to drop the conversation encouragers that's going to cause you to drop, you know, share a lot more information from me so I know where you're coming from.
That's interesting. What other techniques are you doing to collapse the timeline so that you're not having to golf for 8 hours?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's an old saying, you should listen twice. You got two ears and one mouth. It means you should listen twice as much as you talk. Actually, you should listen five times as much as you talk because you got two ears, two eyes, and a nose. And you're picking up data based on what you see, what you hear, and what you sense, what you smell. So I'm going to, instead of trying to pitch my program, instead of make my argument, if you think negotiation is argument-based, then you're a loser. You're leaving money on the table. You're not making anywhere near as many deals as you should. I don't think it's argument-based. I think I need to hear where you're coming from first. So the real thing I need to do is I need to let you know that I'm actually interested in what you have to say. And I'm not going to contradict it. I'm not going to argue it. Or I'm not going to try to show you how you're wrong. I'm going to be genuinely curious. And as soon as you sense that I'm genuinely curious, you are going to vomit information. I mean, I frequently am going to have trouble getting you to shut up. But you're going to give me all I need to make the deal as soon as I get you talking.
And what are some other things that would improve most people in their negotiation skills?
Well, you know, a way to genuinely encourage someone is the simple statement, seems like you've given this a lot of thought. Like that'll work to open the other person up regardless of circumstances. If I'm a terrorist and I say, you know what, we want all U.S. forces out of Iraq in the next 48 hours. As a negotiator, I can say, seems like you've given us a lot of thought. You know, if we're in a business deal, and I say to you, like, look, we got to have this product scheduled and ready for delivery in the next month. I can look at you and say, seems like you've given us a lot of thought. In both instances, the person on the other side has given it a lot of thought. And since they put that much effort into it, they're actually dying to tell me. And what I just said, seems like you've given us a lot of thought, is actually a very specifically worded, every word in that sentence has been selected to unlock you and get you gushing at me about everything you've been thinking about.
So it seems like the starting place for learning about negotiating is both sides have equal leverage. What about when you dial that so that you have low leverage in a negotiation? How does that change the dynamic?
All right. So we didn't even talk about in terms of leverage anymore. Like in a Black Swan group, we used to say there's always leverage. Jim Camp, who I worked a lot with, learned a lot from, he wrote a book called Start With No, said there's no such thing as leverage. I mean, if you really understand negotiation, you don't talk in terms of leverage at all. And the first thing is that somebody starts talking about, where's the leverage? Where's the leverage? Leverage is like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. So first of all, if you're talking to me at all, I have leverage, no matter what the perceived value is. If you don't even have to be talking to me, if you're talking, I have leverage. If you're expressing a desire, either by words or actions, there's something you want. So if I'm going to think in terms of leverage, I got leverage because you want something. You really begin to change the game when you think in terms of influence instead of leverage. And then you start thinking in terms of long-term influence and what causes influence to last. Now, that's a shrewd negotiator. And that's a negotiator that can cut deals because they're always untanking the dynamic and thinking about it in emotional intelligence terms, which is quantum leap from leverage thinking.
It does seem, though, if you want something more than the other person, at its core, you're coming from a disadvantage. Is that not accurate?
It's a good point. The more you desire something, the more you've taken you hostage. I mean, there's an old saying in negotiations, he or she who cares least wins. You know, you care most, you're taking you hostage. And it's kind of gets back to your question earlier. What's the biggest mistake you make? Take yourself hostage. If you're scared of revealing information, you've taken yourself hostage. If you're concerned about the outcome, concern is a manifestation of fear in disguise. You're afraid of losing something. You've taken yourself hostage. It's understanding all the different ways that you take yourself hostage. You do the other side's job for them.
What are some of the other paradigms that people get incorrect when they're thinking about negotiating?
Wow. Yeah, well, you got to make your case. One paradigm that we, in my company, that we differ dramatically from the academics on is, you know, the academics will tell you to anchor high. Go first, anchor high. Throw out a number soon. The vast majority of the great practitioners will say he or she who names price first loses. So a lot of people want to throw a number early and try to anchor the discussion. In point of fact, what that does is it makes lots of deals go away. It drives people away from the table that you should have otherwise made a deal with. And I find it to be really consistent among the really good practitioners of negotiation. They will not throw a number first. They want to know what number you think it should be. Then they're going to try to construct a deal around that number because they've seen too many deals driven away by somebody dropping a bad number, an extreme number, too soon.
Because if you throw a number, you're anchoring to that number, and a good negotiator will do everything they can to give you that number and take everything else off the table.
Well, they really will, right? They can fool you. They can fool you in so many different ways. I mean, yeah, if you get emotionally invested in a number, you can really be taken advantage of.
So what about if you're dealing with, let's say, somebody who's hard-headed and has a big ego? How do you switch the dial of negotiating, or do you?
Yeah, those guys are great. Those are control-oriented people. I mean, one of the things we say is a secret to gaining the upper hand in a negotiation is give the other side the illusion of control. Like who we perceive people as having really big egos, they're actually ridiculously insecure. You know, they're incredibly susceptible of flattery to deference, you know? And so those people, you know what? You want to be in control? I say, wow, you're in control. Oh man, you're so awesome. You're so in control. And they drop their guard. So, you know, if they wear those kind of emotions on their sleeve so much so that their reputation precedes it, you know, those people are so vulnerable to being told that they're great. You can get almost anything you want out of them.
And what about over email? So there's a lot of different ways people communicate. When you lose the voice, how does that change the dynamic?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, the two big problems with email is tone. And then secondly, that emails are just too long. And long emails, it's the dumbest thing on the planet because I don't know anybody that wants to read a long email. And almost everybody writes them.
Right.
So, you know, that's like saying, if I'm a chef, let me serve people food I hate. That's dumb. That just makes no sense. But the tone issue is, you know, we write an email with a certain tone in our head, and we don't realize that it's going to come across as cold and distant at best. My son is the chief negotiator for the Black Swan Group. He's really good at this stuff. And he likes to say, take an email and read it back to yourself in the harshest tone you can imagine, because that's the way the other side's going to read it. Like, ah, well, I don't mean it that way. Yeah, well, how you meant it is not how it's going to be read. I was in the FBI one time. I get this email message that, you know, you're scheduling people to work around a clock. So does that mean they're entitled to overtime? The FBI doesn't give overtime. And, you know, I wrote a one-word email, no. And I meant it as no, you know, real nice and soft and gentle. Well, the other side got the one-word email, no. And they heard it as no, you know, so that's what's going to happen. It didn't matter that I meant it in a soft, friendly, kind tone of voice. It wasn't read that way. So understand what you hear in your head when you're writing it is not the way they're going
to
read it.
So you really have to spell it out.
Well, you know, what you really got to do is soften it up. And one of the ridiculous easy ways is to drop in, I'm sorry, and I'm afraid. So if my answer is no, I'd say, look, I'm sorry. I'm afraid the answer is no. I'm sorry you're not going to like this. I'm afraid there's nothing I can do. I'm sorry, but the answer is no. Poof. I dropped in a whole bunch of I'm sorry and I'm afraid before I deliver the bad news. Not after. It's critical to deliver those before. And then they soften it up and it lands the way you want it to land.
So one negotiation that is probably pretty common amongst everybody, not to me since I work for the government, but trying to get paid more for the work that they're doing. How do people typically screw that up? And what's a better way for someone to go into a salary negotiation with their boss?
It's almost cliche. I mean, negotiate your career. And your salary will come along with it. How do you negotiate your career? Show that you want to bring more to the table than just taking salary away. A colleague of mine, in every single job interview and every annual review, he's always said, how can I be guaranteed to be involved in projects critical to our strategic future? Now, that's a game-changing request, because instead of you walking in the door and saying, how can I get more for me? You're saying, how do I get more for us to take us into the future? As soon as you take your focus off of you and onto the health of the team and the future, then that makes you incredibly more valuable. So you will build your resume, which makes you more valuable either to that company or to somebody else, who, if that company won't pay you, and not all of them will, somebody else will, because of all the great stuff that you've done. So it's really about negotiating your future success. And then your salary follows along behind it.
So what sort of exercises do you guys do to make somebody a better negotiator?
We teach people really how to hear the other side out in the quickest way possible, how to encourage people, how to let them know you're listening, how to stop this nonsense about common ground or getting them to say yes. I mean, you get rid of a few bad habits and you can move your negotiation ability forward really fast. Stop pitching and start listening. And then so we do simple exercises where we have two people sit down. One person talks about their passion. The other person encourages them to talk about it with no self-disclosure, with no sharing of common ground. You know, if you like puppy dogs, most people say, yeah, I had a dog when I was a kid. Or they'll say, yeah, you know, I didn't have a dog when I was a kid. I don't know how to relate to that. But I can still ask you about your puppy dog. I don't need to relate to it or not, one way or the other, to be genuinely interested. And doing some practice like that opens up conversations really fast.
So kind of a yes and to try and build on top of whatever they're saying.
Yeah, it's really and. I mean, it's using yes as an encourager, saying yes versus hearing yes. Those are two completely different things. So it's, you know, and getting the other side to talk instead of you talking. Yes is an interesting word. We love hearing it. We hate saying it.
Any other exercises that you work with people on?
No, that's it. You know, that's the main one. You know, that's the starting point. And then we start to say, all right, now let's take the same skill set and dive in and start looking. And here's what you look for when you're trying to find out what they're really driven by or how they're really looking at the future. Or if they're looking at the future in a very pessimistic way, how can you go in with the same set of skills and dial in a different view?
So being an expert negotiator and having shared a lot of the things that you've learned with your family, with your son, with your friends, do they know when you're using your techniques on them?
Of course they do. I mean, the real issue isn't, are you using techniques? It's why are you using them? You know, am I using it to create a genuine collaboration or am I using it to exploit you? Inside my company, we believe you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go as a team. Strong team game, highly collaborative. We use this stuff on each other all the time because it gets at the heart of the matter quicker. And the issue is, why are we using these skills? We're using those so we can go farther as a team. If you're using them on me so that you can go far as an individual, which is at my expense, now I got a problem with that. So it's not that the skills are being used, it's to what end?
As long as everybody is on the same page and being authentic, then it's going to be easier for you guys to collaborate.
Makes all the difference in the world. Yeah.
So what projects are you working on now as an individual as well as your company?
Well, we're putting out more material in other formats. We're holding more events, coaching more. I mean, you know, there's a lot of bad negotiation out there. We're trying to figure out every way possible to get people better. So yeah, we're doing it on all levels. We're building out a YouTube channel. I mean, we're adding subscribers to our newsletter. We put a lot of free content out there, a lot of free content. Because you can get a long way with just a book and the free content that we put out.
And where can people keep up with you, find that free content, subscribe to the newsletter, those things?
Yeah, the newsletter is a gateway to everything, man. The newsletter is the best way. We get training announcements in there, materials announcements, and it's a very concise newsletter also. It's not one of those that has 20 options. You don't know which way to go. So the best way to subscribe to the newsletter is there's a text to sign up function. The number you're texting to is 22828. And again, that's 22828. And the message you send to 22828 is FBI empathy, all one word, lowercase. Don't let your autocorrect put a space between FBI and empathy. It's got to be one unbroken word. And you send that, you get a response back asking for your email address. Send the email. It signs you up for the newsletter, which is free, comes out every Tuesday. It's concise. And then it's a gateway to everything else that we do.
Chris, thanks for doing this. This was eye-opening. I certainly learned a lot and look forward to keeping up with what you're doing.
Yeah, my pleasure, brother. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to review it. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that have helped me over the last month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. The link to the newsletter is also in the show notes. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all their watches by going to Bremont.com. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.